Welcome to the Mother Earth's Heroes Show. So today I have Brian Welch. He's the CEO of Mindful.org and is basically one of the leading figures of Octon Publications. And Octon Publications is really one of those information resources that started with the whole sustainability movement. There was one a particular magazine that catched my eye where I also know you from. I know you from YouTube, and you talked about the Mother Earth's news. So Brian Welch, I'm happy to have you here, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
So Brian, maybe we can go into this space because you are someone who really has your finger on the pulse, right? You have been writing about this topic. You have a company that is writing about sustainability. So maybe you can share with us and maybe give us a little bit of hope even to get started. What is happening really behind the scenes? What hasn't hit the mainstream yet? What is something that you can share that is helping us to get a grip on? Because we only see statistics. We are not hitting our CO2 goals. We are not doing that. We are not doing that. But what are we doing? What is working well at the moment?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, I think the thing that's working best is the growing awareness. The thing that's most inspiring to me is the growing recognition that people all over the world and in every socioeconomic category, the degree to which they're starting to realize that we have problems that must be solved. I suppose the one issue that has been most fascinating to me over the decades is the issue of human population growth and human consumption. Mm-hmm. We continue to avoid talking explicitly about human population, and yet human population really drives every form of environmental problem we have. The human population has more than doubled in my lifetime. And every biologist will tell you, any biologist would say, that no species can continue in that kind of pattern for very long. Yeah. Because one or the other of the resources they need to sustain themselves is depleted. And we're facing the depletion of a lot of different resources. And so I try to talk about population as often as I can because, you know, we have this beautiful opportunity, really, to start talking about population, to consciously and humanely reduce the human population to a level where our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren can look forward to ongoing sustainability, really a limitless future. The only fundamental problem we have is that there are too many of us, and we continue to expand both our population and our consumption.
That is interesting. Sustainability has so many intricacies, right? It's such a big topic, and it touches so many points. So that you go to, in other words, what you're saying is we are the problem, right? And if
for sure.
Less of us, then we would have less of a problem, right?
For sure.
And in fact,
it doesn't even need to be a problem. You know, we're not inherently bad.
Yeah.
It's not inherently wrong to be human, but it breaks a bunch of ecological rules when you expand as rapidly as we have. And we, for a variety of reasons, probably most fundamentally our biological programming, which dictates that we expand and reproduce. But for a variety of reasons, we failed to come to grips with that. I mean, I started out as an environmental journalist in the 1970s. And people were very reluctant to talk about the human population growth at that time. And they're still very reluctant to talk about human population growth. But in the meantime, what have we added about, since I began my career, I guess we've added about 3 billion people or 3.5 billion people,
yeah,
to the planet. This is the fundamental problem. And we have the scientific means, the technological means of limiting our population growth. We have the social structures necessary to support reducing the human population in a humane way, but we fail to come to grips with it for a variety of, I think, outmoded reasons, effectively taboos, when it comes to talking about reducing how many people live on the planet.
Which topics are you referring to? Are you talking about limiting the amount of children families can have, sort of like the one child policy, or sort of the anti baby pill, or do you think of more innovative solutions, or what is it what you think about when you talk about reduction of population?
Well, you know, the most fundamental, the most effective tools we have for this, I think, are improving economic equity. In other words, making our economies fairer, so that the people at the bottom of the economic ladder are not really forced to have a lot of children in order to support themselves in their old age. I mean, that's effectively how it works for about 40% of the human population today. There's no social safety net. So if you're going to have a comfortable old age, you need a bunch of children around to help support you in that phase of your life. We can create economic incentives around the world for people to have smaller families. And those incentives, you know, exist in the developed world in a sort of de facto way. You know that if you have two kids, you can educate them better and they do better. So there's that kind of, but those incentives are not built into every economy or every culture.
Yeah.
But far simpler, a far more fundamental measure would be just to lift the taboo on the discussion and to begin raising the issue in all of these places where we talk about sustainability.
Yeah.
You know, you can apply every possible mitigation you can think of to the problem of climate change. But if we continue to expand the population at the rate we're expanding it, those mitigations are not going to have a meaningful impact.
So we are not targeting the core issue. We're just like trying to solve something in order to have the feeling of having progress. But at the end, you think we are not targeting the biggest lever at the end?
I think we're not even acknowledging the biggest lever. We've averted our gaze from the most fundamental tool at our disposal. And it's a tool which could effectively mitigate every other problem we're facing.
It is not a topic that is often talked about. That's true. No one of our guests ever talked about this as sort of... You're talking about it as if it's really... It should be high on our priority list, right? It should be
top priority.
It should be talked about at the General Assembly. It should be talked about at all the online conferences or conferences. And you are attending these conferences, right? You've been to the CEO summit where it was about we have to sort of this. Stakeholder capitalism movement that is emerging. Sure. And is it talked about? So where does your perspective come from that it's not talked about enough?
It's very rarely addressed. There is a global taboo, maybe slightly too strong a word, because it's not actively forbidden, but it's an issue that's very seldom raised, and it is the core issue to any discussion of sustainability. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if we continue to expand at the rate we've been expanding, none of our other measures can possibly solve the core problem. It's not as though the question is whether we keep expanding or whether we don't keep expanding. We can't continue to expand. There's a lot of fantasies out there about colonizing other planets, but we've explored as far as our technology will reach, and we've not found anything remotely resembling a planet that we could inhabit in a long-term way. So we have this one planet. We cannot continue expanding. I mean, the fact that we will have to reduce the human population is inescapable. At least stop its expansion, but I think probably reduce it. And it's not a question of whether, it's a question of when.
Yeah.
And, you know, really what we talk about when we talk about this issue, we're not even making a choice about whether to reduce the population or not. If we continue to expand, nature will reduce the human population. And so...
You think about that nature is inherently driven to have to maintain balance, and when they notice, okay, it's like an anthill and the ants are getting too much, and then a dinosaur comes over or a big giraffe or an elephant and steps on the anthill. So you believe in that that's sort of an inherent energy.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Nature will the global ecological system will eventually make the adjustment. But we've seen nature make those adjustments. And I think any human being who's familiar with how nature does it would rather take control of our own fate and moderate, reverse our own expansion in humane ways, because nature's tools are quite ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
And
so it's a volcano, or it's a big wave, or something like that.
Well, or a global pandemic,
or a global, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or a some sort of environment, a climate event like a big volcano eruption that instantaneously reduces our ability to produce food by half. Imagine if our global food supply was suddenly reduced by half due to some sort of geologic event like that. Well, we would watch billions of people starve, because we run all of our systems at their limits. I find it fascinating that we don't question the quality of our systems in a framework, that we don't judge them in a framework that includes their ability to respond to crisis. The global economic system, we're facing right now a global pandemic whose mortality rate is probably somewhere under 1%, certainly not over 3%. And yet, because the economy is so overheated all the time, because we drive our economic system so hard, we're looking at the very real possibility of a global economic depression. Many developed nations are facing 20 and 25% unemployment rates. Markets have, over the course of in the heat of the crisis, were falling by sometimes 9, 10, 11% per day. Yeah. And this is a disease whose mortality rate is actually rather small.
Yeah.
But the economy depends on constant growth. All of our economic systems today depend on constant growth. And things are valued in such a way that everything has to run all out all the time. There's a kind of efficiency in that, but that efficiency is, I think, it's completely overwhelmed by even a minor negative adjustment. One of the things I think people don't generally realize about our economic systems is they're only a few hundred years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really less than 300 years that we've had industrial economies anywhere. And so I would suggest that maybe we don't have a very good one yet. You know, that there's a lot of work to be done to create economies that are resilient to in such a way that they can survive catastrophe. But,
yeah,
you know, that requires producing surpluses on a regular basis. It requires a kind of intellectual and philosophical generosity that is really anathema to the way most modern industrial economies are structured. In effect, what you should have, I think, is a planet where 40% of the land mass is wilderness, is agricultural systems that produce 140 or 150% of the food necessary to support the human population, economies that provide every citizen with at least a minimum standard of living, which we all agree is both humane and dignified. It's that kind of surplus production that we've excluded from contemporary economic systems, and it leaves us extremely vulnerable for no good reason, I think.
I didn't fully grasp that point with the surplus yet. So you say you have something we should work on, right? Like we should have a system that is more of a fair system to everyone who's participating in it, and we should keep the nature as it is, give it 40% of our planet and just have it bewildered, but also keep our oceans clean, right? Like these are healthy, clean demands. But yet I didn't understand the surplus. What do you think is hindering us in achieving that, and why have we been so off track from the 1950s till now, and why do we just understand it now that we are off track?
Well, I think we're off track because there have always been vested interests whose prosperity was dependent upon scarcity. Because those vested interests always existed, there has been the tacit recognition, that is, the silent recognition, that scarcity, that some degree of poverty creates a captive workforce, that wealth can be created for a few people by making access to basic resources expensive for a lot of people. And the whole notion of a laissez-faire economy, of the free hand of capitalism, is, yes, constructive in certain ways, but it has historically supported the wealthy at the expense of the poor. And we are reluctant to acknowledge that aspect of capitalist economies. And so we develop this notion of efficiency that excludes the possibility of sudden reversal, that excludes the possibility of reducing the rate of growth, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there have been, because of population growth, there have been more customers every day since the dawn of the industrial economy. And so we've built systems that are dependent upon that constant growth, and we do not have economic systems that create prosperity in the absence of population growth.
All right, so now we're getting more to the core. You say what is really interesting, because I'm myself a student of marketing, and marketing is filled with tricking people into buying stuff they don't need for reason that they don't, others don't care. But it's fascinating to see like these biases, and the reasons why people make a purchase is highly irrational oftentimes. And what you say is that capitalism is basically based on a massive bias of scarcity, and that when the scarcity would stop, also the, I'm not really sure if I'm making the analogy correctly, but if the scarcity would stop, then also the increasing population would stop. But it's both totally connected. It's connected that the growth of population is connected to the system that our capitalistic regime is running on.
Sure. I mean, to take the simplest illustration, imagine what would happen if for some reason the human population started decreasing, for any reason, the human population started decreasing by 3% per year.
Yeah.
Well,
Instead of increasing,
there would immediately be if you just run the math, you immediately see a massive oversupply of housing. To take the simplest possible illustration,
mm-hmm.
You suddenly have a massive oversupply of housing every year, compounding 3% and then 7% and then 15% of housing is vacant, even if we're not building any. And so what happens to the price of housing? What happens to the price of real estate? Well, without the expectation of appreciation, much less the expectation of a sudden radical depreciation, then that whole foundational element in the economy collapses.
Yeah.
I mean, suddenly housing is worth almost nothing. It'll become almost free in a very short time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have no economic tools for addressing that situation. Certainly, the laissez-faire economy would collapse without some kind of mindful intervention on the part of major social institutions. There would be suddenly no real estate market, no value for housing. And it's almost impossible to imagine. And yet it looms right there in front of us.
Yeah, once you make the connection, it's a little bit scary. Like I always ask myself, where's the increasing customers coming from, right? Like there's just so much that you can buy as an individual. And it's sort of this dream that there are infinite amount of customers for your product. And that's sort of also what we preach, right? Like we say, for example, you can use Facebook ads and it's an infinite amount of people that, that can't be exhausted. But at the end, it isn't. Right? Like it's behind there, we have hard numbers, an algorithm that can just target a minimum amount of people. So what your address is really like, let's get realistic. Let's look at the numbers and see what our economy is really based on. Like,
yes,
in dry fashion, like just look at the numbers, look at the facts.
Yes. I hope, hundreds of thousands of the smartest young people become economists and start studying for the first time what kind of economy creates prosperity in the context of a falling human population or environmental catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the economy's purpose, if you want to get down to it, is to take care of people.
Yeah.
The economy doesn't have any other purpose other than taking care of people. And our economy is not very good at it. And is really terrible at it if we, you know, if we or nature reduces the human population by any significant degree or even stabilizes it. Our economies can't survive a stabilization, much less a reduction.
Yeah, it's like it's born for the up and downs, right? Our economy is born for the up and downs and for the growth curve.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk about internationalization at the moment, right? Like it started with globalization, but now also with software, and like we all have that dream when we internationalize. When we go back to the micro, I also have some clients who are like, if I internationalize my app, then I get more customers. But let's maybe think about that 10 years further. Like, what if we internationalized? Do you think that there's a limit to that? Like, that at some point we won't have people buying products and the system is supposed to break? Do you believe in something like that?
Well, the current economy is built like a Formula One race car.
Okay.
It's designed to run, to generate extreme power while consuming enormous resources for a very short period of time.
And most of it is waste.
Well, there's a lot of waste, but I'm slightly worried about the focus on waste, because again, mm-hmm. a stable food system would have to be producing a surplus that was capable of adjusting in the case of an environmental catastrophe. That means lots of waste. That, I mean, it doesn't really get wasted. It gets composted. It goes back into soils. There's nature recycles everything. But really producing a lot of extra food is a very good idea, because one of these days something's going to happen. And lots and lots and lots of our current croplands will not be productive for some period of time. And, you know, if we don't want to live through a really horrendous period of human suffering and death, we need that. We need to generate surpluses. I think, though, when back to your question about internationalization, which is a question that really fascinates me, I think right now, because of the way the economies are structured, we've generated a lot of prosperity and wealth over the last two decades,
yeah,
through internationalization and through the elevation of the economies of countries like India and China.
Yes.
And as a result, their consumption of natural resources and their contribution to global warming and to pollution and all the negative effects of the human population globally have been amplified in those countries, you know, because they're more wealthy. And so it's another really sort of tragic aspect of the way our economies are structured, that if we raise the standard of living in places that have been very poor, then we also aggravate their negative impacts on the environment on a per capita basis.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking a lot recently about how different our approaches to all these things would be if we incorporated compassion as a criterion for success in all the things we do.
What do you mean by that? What I mean is
internationalization has in the past too often been exploitative. Hey, look, you know, we could sell this cheap stuff in enormous quantities to these people who don't have it in these poor countries. And because they don't have any other source for it, we could jack the price up, create a sense of scarcity, you know. Or, oh, look, we can produce food much more cheaply if we import illegal labor, undocumented labor, and pay them less than we've identified the minimum standard of living would dictate. That's how we do it in the United States, of course. I mean, not too long before that, we literally kept people as slaves. And people argued in favor of slavery as an economic necessity. We can't maintain our, you know, the view of the people in slaveholding states before the American Civil War was that their economies could not be maintained without the access to slave labor.
Crazy.
Well, you can make sense of almost anything on an economic basis.
Mm-hmm.
Until you introduce the criterion that I would refer to as compassion.
What does compassion mean? It can have a lot of meanings, right? But in yes. which perspective? Sure.
From the way I would define it is as a fundamental concern for reducing suffering and the well-being of all sentient beings is how I would categorize it, which would include every kind of living creature from my perspective. But, you know, let's start with human beings,
mm-hmm.
Because it's simpler for us to define how we'd reduce suffering for other people. We don't presently talk about compassion. It's not a criterion in any of our systems, not our political system, not our economic systems. It's a criterion that is never applied. And yet, in a way, it's the definitive human quality. The one thing that separates us most distinctly from all other living things is that we can make sacrifices for the good of people we will never know in foreign places or future generations, for other creatures. We can consciously make sacrifices to reduce the suffering of others to whom we're not directly connected. As far as we know, no other living thing can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's quite a beautiful thing. I don't really believe that we're going to be able to construct sustainable economic and political systems unless we introduce compassion as a fundamental criterion when we're constructing these systems. And the reason I say that is this. Sacrifice will be necessary. Fewer children, you know, that's a small sacrifice. But I think most people have kind of wrapped their mind around that. But there are also billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of scientists working to extend human lifespans.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
Well, we do understand, of course, that expanding human lifespans has the same cumulative effect as having lots of kids. If we came up with a way of curing cancer tomorrow, we would have to build another New York City metropolitan area every year on top of the current rate of expansion to accommodate the people whose lives were saved by that.
Did you crunch the numbers?
I did.
Okay, yes. That is significant.
If we tomorrow came up with some means of extending human life by 10 years, during those 10 years, we would have to build 8 New York City metropolitan areas a year to accommodate the additional population that longevity has created.
I have one question in regards to that.
Sure.
Because there's, I would call it, let's call it the Star Wars effect, right? The sci-fi effect. Because when we're talking about that we need 8 to 10 New York City metropolitans or metro areas, or basically the Manhattan, right? Then we are talking about something that is already existing and we're just scaling it. But we also have to take into consideration that humanity will develop itself, right? In the next decade, the world could look different than it's now. Like in a sci-fi movie, for example, where we are building such high rises, we are building sustainable hyper loops. Sort of, we start exploring, what is it called? When we beam ourselves from one place to another.
Sure.
And, you know, like, do you think maybe humanity is just on the starting point of that, and we can have trust in technology? I guess this technology optimism, right, which is often referred to. Or is it something we should really be concerned about? Because, like, when we start to stop, or when we really start exploring these topics and we accomplish that, then we're just building our own grave at the end as humanity. But, you know, it's these two sides, right? The techno optimism and the scary fact that you just mentioned, that if we just continue, then we need so many more urban areas.
I mean, you need more everything.
Mm-hmm.
You need millions more acres of farmland.
What about urban gardening, maybe? Or
let me approach it from a slightly different way. Yes, I mean, the techno optimism, I think that all of that helps, but it only constitutes a positive step if it is infused with compassion as a criterion.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just more aggression.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, urban gardening, if it were absolutely maximized, who knows? We're super optimistic. Might decrease the rate of environmental deterioration by 15% or something, right? That's just decreasing the rate of deterioration. It's not reversing anything. It's just as long as we continue to expand, then all we can hope for is decreasing the rate of deterioration. We have the tools at our disposal to actually reverse deterioration and restore the planet that is our legacy. But only if we accept the responsibility for sacrifice that is motivated by real compassion.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, the poster child for techno optimism is probably Ray Kurzweil, right? Do you know who Raymond Kurzweil is?
Ray Kurzweil. I heard about it, but about him.
Well, you know, part of his shtick is live long enough to live forever. He's sort of a health guy, longevity guy, mm-hmm. really believes that in the next 20 years or so, we're going to have 200-year lifespans. That would be an unmitigated environmental catastrophe. And I don't believe that there's any other way of interpreting that from an environmental standpoint. Yes, there's lots of technologies that have a mitigating effect. The only thing from my perspective that has a chance of actually restoring the health of the planet is a substantial reduction of the human population.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires sacrifice.
Yeah.
And sacrifice is very hard to talk about. And people tend not to want to talk about it. But if you start from the perspective, so what brought me to my current major engagement running mindful.org and publishing Mindful Magazine, mm-hmm. was my own search for a way of improving my own capacity for compassion. I found, you know, when I was in my 40s, you know, when I was in my 40s, I found that I would probably have described myself as a very conscientious person. But I didn't, when I really got down to examining myself, I wasn't a very compassionate person. I still relied on aggression in business and in life for accomplishing things. I didn't listen to people the way I could. I didn't care for other people the way I could. Fundamentally, I was unwilling to move towards suffering. I was unwilling, when I encountered suffering, to move toward it to see if I could be of help. And that's sort of the basic practice of compassion. And so I went looking for ways of improving myself in that way. And that brought me to meditation, to mindfulness, to the things that are at the center of my work now. I came there, though, because I was looking for a way to be more compassionate. And I was looking for a way to be more compassionate because I thought I had decided, you know, I thought I had discovered that that's the human quality that on which our survival may rest, may depend. That if we aren't able to sacrifice for the good of the whole, then we may not, then our presence here might not be sustainable.
Mm-hmm. So it starts with consciousness, you say. It starts with being aware something isn't fully working. And you used mindful.org as your channel, so to speak, to make this, get this message out and spread it. Is that the mission statement of mindful.org, what you just mentioned?
Our mission is to spread the practices of mindfulness to reduce human suffering. We limit our goals to reducing human suffering. But I originally moved this direction because I believed that reducing human suffering will reduce suffering in general. You know, people who have a sense of space, people who are cultivating their own capacities for compassion, are people who can devise the new economic systems, political systems, educational systems that we're going to need to create future generations of compassionate human beings that can sustain our population, you know, that can create the kind of world where I want my grandchildren to live.
Yes. We talked about the big picture, right? Like, I am pretty, when you are still listening, then you are now confronted with this big issue, right? This larger than life issue, and we want to change how we are using how we are structuring our economy, what kind of KPI is driving our growth or stop growth altogether. Thank you for sharing these concepts which really seem to be to your heart, but how can we now make it tangible, right? Like,
yeah.
What kind of role does the average entrepreneur play, or maybe even the young entrepreneur play? Like, what is possible, and how can we translate this into action? I mean, it's so easy to say, right? And at the end, we are still doing the same thing and hoping for the best, and somebody else will solve it. But just in general, like, maybe are there movements out there of people that are already trying to change the economy? Sort of like, maybe the Club of Rome is one of them, right? They also have an area for young people, and maybe can you give us a little bit of something tangible that we can use based on your ideas?
Well, that's a very big question. I'm really glad you asked it. I guess I can only speak from my own experience. I think that incorporating conscientiousness and compassion into all of your decisions when you choose what it is you wish to do, how you wish to do it, when you start your company and you design a product and you identify suppliers, if each of those decisions is informed by conscientiousness and compassion, then you've immediately started creating a new world, a better world. It's been a destructive, primary belief in capitalism that the most effective organizations exclude those criteria from their decision making. It's just business. You know what I mean? We can't afford to think about all that other stuff. We have to completely focus on making the most money in the shortest period of time. I think that that simple-minded approach to business has been enormously destructive. And I think it's time to abandon that belief system.
Yes.
But it's deeply ingrained.
Yes.
And in the meantime, we also have to compete against people who are more mercenary, whose motivations are less enlightened. And so when I say our decisions can be informed by conscientiousness and compassion, I'm also acknowledging that they cannot be our exclusive criteria, because we also have to compete in the real world.
There's the talent, the war of talents, and there's the war of market share, right? There are competitors. So what you propose is really that we are part of the system, right? We can't just say we're not part of the system, especially as entrepreneurs or people that are self-starters and that see themselves and that want to become part of the solution. So we have to sort of work with what we have and also have this little bit of ruthlessness in us to be an executive, sort of.
At least pragmatism, right?
Pragmatism. Yeah, thank you. That's maybe a better word. So having a sense of pragmatism and really going for well-informed decisions that help our business, but then also really thinking further. Right. And this right. is not. And do you know Dan Pena, maybe?
I don't think so. No.
Heard of him? No. He's sort of the go-to person for this old economy mindset, which is make money, be ruthless, don't care about what others think or do or care. And this makes a lot of people successful at the moment. So it's getting awareness, right?
Sure.
So how could we make this movement of, let's maybe call it compassionate entrepreneurship or something like that? Uh-huh. How can we apply this to the mainstream so that everybody is sort of building this little bubble of a compassionate entrepreneurship, and this is becoming the go-to way?
Yeah. Well, I think your generation has started in a very effective way, which is by shopping conscientiously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as soon as we can convince consumers that they only want to buy things that are created in conscientious ways, then business will revolutionize itself in a few hours. Mm-hmm. You know. It's all driven by consumers. If every woman in the industrialized world resolved to only buy consumer goods created by companies who had a majority of women on their boards of directors, then women would be the majority on the boards of directors of every Fortune 500 company, literally within hours. The system is set up to be very responsive to consumers.
That's interesting. So you say the fastest way, because my awareness is changing the consumer is really a long game, right? I was always thinking about why not change the producer's mindset. But you say if you want to change the system, actually you have to change the consumer's mindset, and then the response is much faster. Like in hours, I never heard of that, but it's, of course, nobody can say it precisely, but you
I set up an unrealistic idea, which is that every woman in every industrial nation would resolve to do this now.
True.
That's an unrealistic setup.
Yeah.
But if that occurred, all the companies would change immediately. They couldn't afford to resist. I mean, so Procter & Gamble does it in 15 minutes. Well, then Unilever would do it 15 minutes after that because they're watching everything Procter & Gamble does. I mean, there'd be a chain reaction. It would happen, yes, I think within hours.
You know, that sounds sort of like the... like a peaceful revolution in a Gandhi way, maybe even. They couldn't afford to resist. That is really strong. I guess this is gonna be the title of this podcast.
Oh, that's nice. That's very nice.
that's really, really a big word, right? Like or a big sentence that when the adaptation is really necessary in order for them to still approach their economic growth, right? Economic goals.
Yes.
Do you think that's realistic from the bottom of your heart? Do you think that's...
Oh, yes. I think it's the only realistic thing from the bottom of my heart. You know, in my lifetime, I've never seen any fundamental change that was generated from anywhere except the grassroots. The only real fundamental changes occur when individuals change their minds, when people's hearts change. Mm. And part of that is just that really our human energy, our aggregate energy is generated by so many individual hearts and so many individual minds, that any institution you identify is really not extremely potent, you know. It's very hard to dictate any form of change from the top down, and you'll find in history this just doesn't occur.
Mm-hmm.
And the other factor, and which is more Machiavellian, more draconian, is that the most powerful people have the biggest vested interest in preventing change. When you think about it, institutions and individuals who have great wealth and power have that great wealth and power dependent upon the way things work today.
Yeah.
And so there's enormous resistance of change, and the resistance of change increases as you move up the socioeconomic ladder. I think whatever change that you're looking for, you have to address how that change might be affected at the grassroots level. Through what means can you change the minds and open the hearts of the most people, regular people, at that level? I don't know. I can't identify any significant change in human history that's been generated in any other way.
Mm-hmm. So we have to change. It comes back to every decision that we make, right?
Every decision, yes.
It's like the more I interviewed people on the podcast, the more like cliche it sounds. And I was like, I'm getting a little bit, you know, but I guess that's also testing. Maybe also our listeners are feeling that, because it's easy to become bitter about the movement, to be like, ah, why are we making progress?
Disillusioned. Sure.
Disillusioned, and then also maybe going through the phases of frustration and so on.
Grief. Grief. The phases of grief, really. Yes.
Yes.
Well, yeah. I think it's very helpful if you get interested in conscientiousness, if you get interested in compassion. You know, getting hung up on the outcomes, or getting hung up on the idea that you're going to affect the outcome, or getting hung up on the idea that the outcome is going to come within your lifetime, inevitably creates a sense of grief. Because inevitably your ideal will not be realized. And, you know, as an aside, all that stuff is very ego-driven.
Yeah.
But if you become interested in conscientiousness, if you become interested in compassion for its own sake and how you can implement it in your own life, then it's endlessly fascinating. And every day I discover new ways to exercise my compassion. Every day I discover that yesterday I wasn't as good as I could be. And although at 61, my physical fitness potential is greatly reduced from what it once was, my potential for being a compassionate human being is probably greater than it's ever been. And so it's a great sort of lifetime adventure, really. And it's not contingent on any particular outcome.
Yeah, that's a big learning. Just in regards to the time, I mean, I'm almost, I would almost say we have to do another podcast interview.
Yeah, I'm sorry to take up so much time. I guess I've gone on and on.
No, it's great. I mean, it was gripping from the first minute. So that is great. We talked about great topics, but I would like to, maybe you can give us some action items, really, in regards to how can we become more learn more about our own conscientiousness.
Okay.
Maybe even your own resources. What do you have, a blog post maybe that we could lead our listeners to, or mindful, of course, but maybe is there something specific where we can have a starting point?
You know, my book, Beautiful and Abundant, is available as an ebook on Amazon, and a lot of my ideas are there. Mindful.org is my web platform, and a lot of ideas are there. But there's a couple of things I would just say off the top. I mean, first of all, be really friendly to yourself. Be generous and compassionate with yourself. I think that's the most powerful first step anyone can take, because it's really not possible to be compassionate toward the world unless you start with compassion for yourself. It's in my experience and the experience of much wiser and more enlightened people than me, it's been demonstrated over and over again. And so start with that. And then find a practice that sustains your interest in conscientiousness and in compassion. There are hundreds of different practices, some of them religious or spiritual, some of them purely secular. There are tens of thousands of communities of people who work together to sustain and improve their outlook in this way. And so I would recommend a practice and a community. And then hopefully you can develop a passion for it so that your daily life is illuminated by this value, by a value system, by a set of practices, by compassion, by mindfulness. Because then there's no risk of disillusionment, you know, because it's not an illusion to begin with. And it's, for me, been a delightful discovery and really improved my life. And, you know, if through this adventure we're able to create, to reduce suffering and create better lives for other people, future generations, it's a huge bonus.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. My biggest takeaway is really this connection between the core issue and acting compassionately. Mm. Like, because for me, well, I'm in my 20s. I'm in a go-getter mode, and you know, it's easy to not be compassionate. And I try to remind myself, no, you should be aware, you should be compassionate. But now I have really a connection, right? Like I want to be useful for sustainability, and if I can do that by being more compassionate with my actions, that's a good thing. And so this is sort of the cause and effect that I learned today. Thank you so much. Am I on track with this learning?
it's wonderful to hear you voice it in that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Do you want to lead our listeners somewhere? Is there a link? Are you on social media where you want to lead
people? Yeah, sure. Facebook is the easiest way to find me and communicate with me. They can probably see the spelling of my name. I hope so. Brian, Bryan Welch, Welch.
Yes.
And yeah, Facebook, or you can always reach me at Bryan@mindful.org.
I also recommend checking out mindful.org and also checking out your LinkedIn profile, because there you find an overview of all the projects that you're working on. And hopefully people check out mindful.org and start getting on that journey. And Brian, thank you so much. We are now at 1 hour. But it was a very good interview. Thank you so much.
Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Being part of the Mother is Heroes show.
Thank you.